So you would like, where would you like to start with 19 before we hit 20?
What I'm saying is the first three verses of 20, I think, belong to 19. It should be the end of 19 because it's a more logical break.
Why don't we, and that's very possible, why don't we start with verse 19 in chapter 19
Yeah.
and go to 21, and then why don't we read that whole section down to 20, verse 3?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Nancy, would you read for us, please?
Okay, I did hear starting with 19:19 and reading through chapter 20, verse 3.
Yes,
Okay,
correct.
so here we go. I'm using Free Bible. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth gathered together to wage war on the one sitting on the horse and his army. The beast was captured along with the false prophet who performed miracles in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worship the beast image. Both of them were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. The rest were killed with the sword of the one sitting on the horse, the sword that came out of his mouth. All the birds gorged themselves on their flesh. I saw an angel descending from heaven, holding the keys of the abyss and a large chain in his hand. He seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him in chains for 1,000 years. The angel threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he would no longer be able to deceive the nations until the 1,000 years were over. After that, he has to be set free for a little while.
Honestly, that's the first time I've ever noticed that those belong together. Of all these years, it never clicked. And we've always said that the ceiling over the abyss is because everybody dies, and that's exactly what the previous verse says. Everybody else died.
Which makes me wonder if the demons die too.
That's a good question. There's no mention, there's no hint of that even.
There's nothing about Satan's angels, or you have them in ch chapter 12, but you don't have them anywhere else.
Well, whether or not they die, I don't think they would provide much consolation or entertainment for him.
No one to deceive.
They're already deceived, so there's nobody left to deceive.
Exactly.
Satan's out of a job.
Yeah. If anything, they would add to his misery.
Know if you guys remember C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, but in a metaphorical way, he had Satan's realm. Basically, they devoured the weakest of their own. And maybe there's something to that, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the point of evil is that it's parasitic and it can't live without something to feed on. And so maybe this is the description of the end stage where there's basically nothing left for him to feed on. He's consumed all of his followers. Just a thought.
That's an interesting thought.
But it also presents a conundrum because if there's nobody left, how do you continue to live if you're a parasite?
Well, that's where the metaphor breaks down,
Yeah, I think so.
but it's when you study satanic systems, authoritarian system, they're always killing off anybody who threatens them. We just listened to a professor give the depth of Stalin's depravity and how many people he murdered and was responsible for. It was just horrendous. But it was just a reaffirmation of this is how these kind of beastly systems work. Nobody's safe, and you're very likely to get killed. And so it was just a reminder of this is how Satan operates.
I'd like to weigh in on that, the concept of like how would Satan live? with nothing to feed on. I think that brings up the topic of we are living in artificial reality. I mean, the fact that Satan it has been alive for 6,000 plus years is because God is artificially keeping him alive. God is artificially keeping all of us alive because, at least outside of grace, what I mean, you know, if you're, you know, pre-fall, when Satan sinned, the automatic result of that was death. But God didn't let that happen because it would have been misunderstood. And so we're all in this artificial reality where we're under God's bubble of grace and we're given time to choose. And
so Satan remains under artificial reality
until the very end.
Yeah.
When it all comes out in the open.
I think that's true. What I've always wondered is where is the rest of his followers?
Yeah.
The Bible doesn't mention them.
Not crucial to the text, I would think.
Well, yeah, I was going to say something similar. That I mean, this is the culmination of the story of the Great Controversy. And really, that story, it centers on God and his representative among the creatures and Lucifer, who's fallen as a Satan. So really, we're bringing back the focus to the central character.
Right.
And what's happening with all the others is not important in the narrative.
Good point.
Because it's a very condensed narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You just don't have the room to say, you know, what kind of brand of toothpaste they use.
Well, one thing that I'm reasonably certain about, given the evidence, is that at some point from here to the end of the chapter, possibly here, because Satan insisted that he represented humanity for he actually had the job for 4,000 years, evidently, according to Job, but he still claims to represent humanity as the prince of this world. But the fact is, he's illegitimate because he's not a human being. How can a non-human represent humans? I have to wonder if part of this hermetically sealing of Satan involves him actually, God accommodating him, his claim to represent humanity, by allowing him to become a human. Because in Ezekiel, it says when the dead rise up and they look at him who has been cast down, and they say, is this the man who intimidated nations and, you know, had the continual stroke and all this thing, and they turn against him? And I have to wonder if that's more than a metaphor, if it's actually an accommodation on God's part. It says, you want to represent humans? You've got all these humans that you claim to represent, then you can be a human. And you can die as a human. Something that came to me years ago that seems to fit all the dots. And whether that happens at this point, whether he's left on earth as a human so he can't leave, or whether he's made a human at the last resurrection, I don't know that it's important, but I just get the sense when you link that with Ezekiel 28 or Isaiah 14, I forget which one it is, that it would just make sense that God keeps pulling away all of Satan's excuses and said, okay, you want to be the representative, then you have to be one.
I don't think that Satan's isolated because his deceitful tactic is nowhere accepted in the universe. He's isolated to earth. And, you know, the way I understand Revelation is that those wicked that were living at the time of Jesus's second appearing die because of the glorious brightness of his coming. They're crying for the rocks and the mountains to fall on them. They don't want to be anywhere close back to the who can stand in the presence of an all eternal, all powerful, not all powerful, but all righteous God. So I don't see Satan as changing from a creature to a man. You know, I don't see how that's supported, but you know, he is isolated and miserable because his whole life has been consumed with deception and murder and all these ongoing shenanigans that he's been pulling off on planet Earth. So I think he's absolutely miserable because he's, as Gene said, he's out of a job, you know, and nobody else is listening. Nobody's around to listen. But it doesn't change his tactic, you know, however long 1,000 years is, he doesn't change. He goes right back to work as soon, you know, saying, let's take the throne of God. Here he's back at it again. I want to seize the throne, storm heaven, and rule.
I'm looking here at Isaiah 14. And it seems that verses 15 to the end of the chapter are almost parallel to the verses we were reading. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the depths of the pit. Those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities, who would not let his prisoners go home? All kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you are cast out away from your grave, like a loathsome carrion, clothed with the dead, those pierced by the sword who go down to the stones of the pit, like a corpse trampled underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land. You have killed your people.
Is that, where were you again? Ezekiel, or were you?
Isaiah 14.
Yeah. Isaiah 14. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. And I believe it's important to keep in mind that when it talks about drawing their swords against you, and I think that's also in Ezekiel 28. If we use the metaphor of a sword as the words coming out of the mouth, which is clearly how it's applied with Jesus, then when they draw their swords against your beauty, they turn on him. He loses all credibility. Mm-hmm. All credibility, which is all he has to live on.
I think no matter what state he's in, that is key to understand, that he's lost everything.
Nobody will believe a word he says.
And he's not bound by God making fetters around him. He's right. Not bound even by God's light. He is bound by his own choices.
Mm-hmm.
And their results.
Yeah, God's not suddenly exercising force.
No.
I was agreeing with what Nancy shared about how he's bound, not because he can't get off the earth, but because there's nowhere in the universe where his lies have any foothold anymore. Because the wicked are dead and the righteous are in heaven and they're not into his lies anymore. As far as that verse, it's definitely not the dominant translation, but one of the definition words it looked like was champion. And that actually makes sense in the context, because it's like, is this the champion that did thus and such? So
finally reaping the consequences of his great evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're starting to see that. It always seemed like he was above it and nothing could touch him and he could just keep going. And now he is in the abyss, sealed and shut.
Yeah, because we understand, and I don't think this has ever been questioned by anyone, we understand that the beginning of 1,000 years, there's nobody living except Satan. And of course, the righteous who are already in heaven, but nobody living on this earth.
So am I to understand then, do we understand the verse 19:20, where the beast and false prophet are thrown into the lake of fire alive. Are you like a
Lake of
burning
fire for
sulfur?
sulfur. Well, if the lake of fire is emotional agony, which is how Ellen White, I think, reads it. And April 14, 1898, Signs of the Times. She has an interesting statement. And she says, we read of the fire, the worm that dieth not, and the fire that is not quenched. Thus is the pictured the results of, and I'm forgetting the exact wording. I don't know if you want me to take the time to find the book and find the chapter.
No, I appreciate that. So is the devil the beast here? Or are we thinking of...
I'm talking about the lake of fire. I'm not talking about
right
those entities. It's just she understands the lake of fire to represent emotional agony is how I see it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I have so many friends down there, devout Christians, that see God as the executioner, and he's got a lake of fire, and he's going to keep people alive and torture them forever and ever. And that's a God of love.
That's exactly why I couldn't love God most of my life, because I was taught that.
Why? Exactly.
I don't care how short it is. If God's roasting you alive, even for 5 minutes, it can't be a God of love.
Right. So I think there's something, we brought this up before. Why do we associate fire with vengeance or judgment? And I don't think there's a fire that we understand, because Moses, I mean, God is glorious as a consuming fire.
Well, Ezekiel talks about how Lucifer walked in the midst of the stones of fire.
Right, exactly.
That's why God took 2 years to teach me about what the meaning of fire was, all the way from Genesis to Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
So fire generates light, and light reveals stuff. So the fire is in some ways neutral. All it does is reveal what's there.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be...
It causes judgment.
Yes, judgment in the sense of revelation.
Yes.
As opposed to, well, yes. We all agree it's not imposed. So it kind of makes sense that fire would wind up being on both sides of this equation, because it really is neutral.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, how is it that according to the third angel's message, the wicked they're burnt in the fire? Smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, but they are in the presence of the Lamb.
That's why.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, Ellen White also has a really good quote about, if God were to chain sinners by his side, force them to be in his presence, it would be nothing but sheer torment.
Yeah, it would be torture. Mm-hmm. That's in Greek controversy.
That's why it's mercy to let them go,
mm-hmm.
because it would be worse. That would be hell.
Yes.
Which it is anyway, but he doesn't force them to.
No.
And the wicked have said that multiple times in Revelation. Hide us from him who sits on. We'd rather have a rock slide avalanche cover us than be exposed to looking at Jesus.
What's also interesting is I came across an article or a statement by her talking about that very quotation where they're calling out on the rocks and the mountains. And then she says, but nature refuses to accommodate their desire.
Mm-hmm.
So the rocks and mountains will not fall on them.
So maybe this kind of dovetails with what you're just saying. I want to put in a couple of caveats here. I'm not talking about retributive punishment, nor do I want to be misunderstood as a dualist. But I believe that the thing that transports us from being mechanical robots, biological, complicated for sure, but to go beyond that, to make a free choice outside of the realm of our mechanical existence, requires a little piece of God's prerogative to move outside the rules of mechanics to make a choice. My understanding of the second death is when that goes away. Since that's a piece of God, I wonder if that doesn't disappear until God steps in and says, yeah, that's the right thing to do. I'm going to let go of this piece of myself.
When you say the piece of yourself, you mean the piece that would keep them alive?
The piece that is
their free will,
image of God, that boosts them from being a machine to being something made in the image of God. That's a, I don't know how to talk about it without sounding dualistic or like we are God, but I think there's a tiny piece of himself that God gives to each one of us to say, do with this what you will.
Well, Ellen White calls it the kingly power of will.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I call that a piece of divinity, is our free will.
Yeah, right. And I do too. Right. So what I'm saying is that we can't let go of that without God's okay.
Oh, I see. In order for us to die, we have to not be bound to choose him.
Well, you're talking about what would get us to that place. What I'm saying is that however we get there, God has to agree to that it's time for us that we can go.
And I believe that's why the only way anyone will ever experience eternal death, in my opinion, is if they go to God and demand, just like Judas took the money back and threw it down in the temple, said, I don't want it anymore.
Bingo. Bingo. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
That's why I believe that after the last resurrection, they are given conditional immortal life to do with as they choose. And they bring it back to God when all there is left is torment because there's nothing but love everywhere. They come back to God publicly and they throw it down. They say, don't ever resurrect me again. I hate you. Take this back. And that's what completely exonerates God and proves that he is not complicit in their death. He is only agreeing to their demand.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. Exactly.
Yeah. The closest we can get in our way of looking at, I think, it may, in certain details, function a little differently, but I think that's as close as we can get as human beings to that point.
Oh, I mean, all of this is our metaphors and our reasoning by analogy for things that are infinite and beyond us.
Exactly. Trying to understand the mysteries of God. I would like to raise a question. When the gates are open, Ellen White pictures this in Great Controversy. When the gates are open to the New Jerusalem, is there a kind of judgment taking place? Why is she in heaven and not me?
You're talking about when the gates are open or when they're closed?
When the gates are open, they can go up to the gates. They can't get in because of the glory of God. But they can go up to the gatekeeper. I don't think it's Peter, but anyway, to the gatekeeper and demand an answer to a question.
This is during the millennial.
This is at the end of the millennium. After the 1,000 years.
Okay, well, so the new Jerusalem.
The new Jerusalem comes down from God out of heaven. The dead, the wicked dead are raised, and the gates are left open to the new Jerusalem.
Right.
Is it possible that there's considerable discussion, at least, if not a kind of judgment going on, where they are questioning God's decision not to take them to heaven?
According to Jesus, it is. the sheep and the goats, and they're protesting, saying, but we did all these things in your name. I think, yeah, I definitely think there's going to be a lot of challenges.
I wonder if only those who, in fact, would have questions are, in fact, brought back at that point. I mean, somebody who's had no chance, there's no question.
Well, there, Ellen White actually intimates that the those slaves.
So, I mean, people who just never had a chance.
Yeah, exactly.
That God would say, you know, this person's not going to have any questions about it. Let's just let them be as though they never were, I think is the way Ellen White puts it. And it's only the ones that say, God, I really belong. You know, I have served you all my life. Mm-hmm. Why am I not in there? God says, you know, I need to give this guy a chance to have his questions answered.
Yeah.
Bring him back.
Yeah.
Well, I was just scanning some of chapter 42 of Great Controversy, and it's interesting because she's looking right at Revelation 20, and she says, as soon as the books of the records are open and the eyes, ironically, this is Great Controversy 666. I don't know, is that the page? Anyway, as soon as the books of the records open and the eyes of Jesus look upon the wicked, they are conscience of every sin which they have ever committed. They see just where their feet diverge from the path of purity and holiness, just how far pride and rebellion have carried them in the violation of the law of God, the seductive temptations which they encourage by indulgence in sin, the blessings perverted, the messengers of God's despised, the warnings rejected, the ways of mercy beaten back by stubborn, unrepentant hearts, all appear as if it were written in letters of fire. And then she talks about the throne and the panoramic views that are showing up from Adam's fall, successive Jesus's birth, and then people, you know, people like Herod, and anyway, they watch Jesus' agony in Gethsemane. They see, you know, the cross, and then certain people, Annas and Pilate and some of the soldiers and jeering rabble. Anyway, so, you know, Satan and his angels and his subjects have no power to turn from the picture of each of their own work. Each actor calls the part which he performed.
So this has to be because of the light, the glory of God that is being shown on them. That's what, because they have this contrast between them and God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why the rejection of Jesus is because they saw him as so holy, they couldn't stand his presence, because it made them feel terribly guilty.
Anyway, and the other thing I was reading before in the chapter, that when all these people are resurrected as Jesus is coming down, you have the antediluvians, you have major generals, and Satan then pulls off that he doesn't identify him as Satan. He says, I'm supposed to inherit there. Let's all work together. And so they start, you know, making their battle plans and gathering everybody together to attack the city, because he's saying there's a whole lot more of us than there are of them. We can do this. And he doesn't really identify himself as Satan, which I thought was fascinating. I go, I've read Great Controversy before, but I did not remember that. But again, he's back at his old tricks of deceiving and saying, we can do this. That really is my inheritance. He's right back to the same exact place he was, as we saw revealed in Ezekiel 28, Isaiah 14, and Great Controversy. Anyway, it's just amazing. But I think they're stopped in their tracks because they see the reality, the truth, and they know it's truth. And that stops them in their tracks for a while.
What's funny is the end of chapter 20 is like a super magnet that keeps sucking us there, and we haven't read any of it yet.
Not yet.
We've talked about everything except the verses we read.
Well, we have been talking about he's in the abyss with nobody to deceive.
Yeah.
We were talking about that.
And the fire, the lake of fire. I've got a lot of questions about what fire is.
We haven't answered that one.
Because there's more than one fire.
And there's three.
May I request we read those verses again?
Starting at 19, or which one are you can mark?
Whatever ones we read at the beginning that we haven't talked about yet. Refresh my memory on what we were supposed to be talking about.
I haven't heard us talking about this. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth gathered together to wage war on the one sitting on the horse and his army. The beast was captured along with a false prophet who performed miracles in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who had worshipped the beast image. Both of them were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. The rest were killed with the sword of the one sitting on the horse, the sword that came out of his mouth. All the birds gorged themselves on their flesh. So we had talked about those first three at length. Don't we identify the beast as that?
That's tied in with the next three.
Well, I can read the next three too. I mean, I did. We started talking about that. I saw an angel.
Because I don't think they're separate.
So I'll read them again. I saw an angel descending from heaven, holding the key of the abyss and a large chain in his hand. He seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him in chains for 1,000 years. The angel threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he would no longer be able to deceive the nations until the 1,000 years were over. After that, he has to be set free for a little while. So when we talk about the beast and the false prophet, we had in the rest of 19, that's when Jesus shows up on the white horse. So that's his second coming, right? Where he's going to get his bride. And so what happens to those nation states and the false coalition that's enforcing the mark of the beast? It's destroyed, you know, right? So when they talk about that's thrown into the fire that burns with sulfur, that's no longer going to work for Satan, right? He doesn't try that same tactic again, right? This is the Federation's enforcing Satan's.
That's a good question.
The beast is destroyed.
I see 21-3 as a reiteration of the previous three. I think they're talking about the exact same thing.
Oh, I always thought it was different because you have got this 1,000 years. Jesus comes second time, 1,000 years, however long that is.
Okay. Other than the 1,000 years, the Jesus comes. Well, look back a few bit and it says they make war against, what is it, the Lamb.
Where are you?
And so he comes with a great chain.
Well, the angel.
Isn't that what it says?
What? I'm not sure what you're asking.
Okay. Let me pull them both up here.
The rest were killed with the sword of the one sitting on the horse, the sword that came out of his mouth, which is truth, light, glory.
Okay. And that is another way of describing the chains that bind him.
Well, how do you?
Isn't that what we were saying at the beginning? Is the chains is that the fact that there's nobody around to tempt, which means they're all dead.
Correct.
Right?
They're all destroyed.
So what I'm saying is it's reiterating it in different words.
When I hear that, verse of 19, what is it, 21, the mouth, he destroys one of the words of his mouth. I think it's 2 Thessalonians 2:8, which talks about destroyed by the words of his mouth and the brightness of his glory.
And you know what that brightness actually means in the Greek?
No, tell me. Fire.
It's not fire. It's not, I mean, I was always raised to think that Jesus comes and literally slays everybody. Physically attacks them and kills them.
Right.
That's just how I was conditioned to believe growing up. And I went back and looked up the word brightness. I think I got tipped off by somebody's sermon. That's not what it means. It means epiphany. It's a reality check. It's not about killing them. It's that suddenly reality breaks through that's the exact opposite of their scenarios. It's the same thing that happened to the disciples that I was just preaching about this morning. At the upper room, they had their agenda, their reality. They were fixated on this militant Messiah king that was about to launch his revolt against the Romans, and that's all they could think about. And Jesus was trying to get them to think differently, but they were so resistant they wouldn't do it. And so they all crashed and burned. They were not ready for what happened in the garden.
Well, it's interesting because light, you know, John 3:19, this is the verdict that light has come into the world, but men refuse to come to the light because their deeds are evil, so they'd rather hide in the darkness. This is the same deal with this fire.
That's right.
Which has God's glory or his character, his is like a consuming fire. They don't want to be around it.
And also, I think not only is this fire describing the presence of the angel coming down out of heaven, but additionally, I see this fire and subsequent fires, lakes of fire, because this is the first of three. This fire is the wrath of man. When a corrupt political dictatorial power is exposed and fully exposed and discredited, the fury of the people that have been exploited or deceived and everything manipulated by that power is unbridled, and it's fury, it's mob rage at being deceived, and they will just go in and destroy everything. And I believe this lake of fire is a combination of the fury of people who've suddenly seen how badly they've been deceived and manipulated, along with the contrast of the innocence and the truth of the love of the Lamb that breaks through like an epiphany and saying, wait, everything we thought about God is a lie. And we hate this version of God. We've been fighting against this version of God, but it's still true. And it's torment. And in this instance, it says that the beast and the false prophet were taken, which parallels verse 1 of the next chapter, or verse 2, he sees the dragon. Well, you just got all the players. You got the beast, the false prophet, and the dragon. And all of the players on the dark side are seized. I believe this does describe the second coming. And it's two ways of describing the second coming. The first three verses are talking about one way, and the next three verses are talking more directly about Satan. But I think it's describing the same timestamp. And it's reiterating it in different words.
May I read the Science of the Times article that I mentioned? Yeah. I won't read all of it. In the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. The wrath of God fell upon Christ. This was the hiding of his Father's countenance. Though innocent, Christ was treated as a sinner that through his merit, sinners who were guilty might be treated as loyal, obedient children of God. Christ died with the sins of the world imputed to him that his righteousness might be imputed to the sinner. Now there was set a vessel for vinegar, and they filled a sponge with vinegar and put it upon his on hyssop and put it to his mouth. When Jesus therefore had received the vinegar, he said, "It is finished." There was a shriek, shrill and agonizing, and the Son of God expired. He died of a broken heart. When the spear was thrust into his side, there flowed forth blood and water. His heart was broken by his mental agony. and the hearts of all who seek the Lord and find him will be broken as they see the result of sin. In his dying agony on the cross, Christ was scorned by the people who claimed to be waiting for the Messiah, but who showed by their actions the value of their spirituality. I'm going to skip down. What a view the character of God Christ sacrificed has opened to the universe. His love for man, far surpassing all human love, has lifted the law of God to its eternal dignity. The attributes of God have been revealed. The holy requirements of his law have been vindicated. The effects of sacrifice on the cross are still felt, but all who would be saved must themselves have an interest in the crucified one. When in his great suffering, Christ felt no pang and bitterness against his Father. He felt no remorse for his own sins, but for the sins of the fallen race. But those who refuse the sin of Christ will one day feel the sting of remorse. Entire obedience to the law of God is the condition of salvation. Those who refuse this, who refuse to accept Christ, this is again the rejectors of his mercy are the ones who suffer the final consequences. When punished for transgression, they will feel despair and hatred. This will be the experience of all who do not enter into Christ's sufferings, for it is a sure consequence of sin. We read of the chains of darkness for the transgressor of God's law. We read of the worm that dieth not, and of the fire that is not quenched. Thus is represented the experience of everyone who has permitted himself to be grafted into the stock of Satan, who has cherished sinful attributes. When it is too late, he will see that sin is the transgression of God's law. He will realize that because of transgression, his soul is cut off from God, and that God's wrath abides on him, the state of being removed from God's presence. This is the fire unquenchable, and by it every unrepentant sinner will be destroyed. Satan strives constantly to lead men into sin, and he who is willing to be led, who refuses to forsake his sins and despises forgiveness and grace, will suffer the results of his course.
So, question for you. Do you see a fire that consumes versus God's glory that is not a consuming fire, or that is? I'm just trying.
Well, if there's several different fires in Revelation, there could be several different fires in Ellen White.
Right. Yeah, it's just not as easy for me to grasp, but I'm sorry.
Well, if you use John 3 as the definition of both the light, which is the fire, and judgment, the light shows up. Whatever it is, it is. It's the glory of God, the truth of God's pure character of love. Mm-hmm. And those who hate the light experience torment. Those who come to the light experience cleansing and transformation. Our choice is the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Our choice is the judgment, how we relate to the fire. The fire is the same. The fire is not different. It consumes sin, not proactively, but reactively in the sinner. He says to Satan in Ezekiel 28, I will draw a flame out from within you and it will consume you. It's a reaction, like an allergic reaction to love, to the intensity of God's presence of love. And he's so foreign to love that he literally consumes from the inside out. And the same thing in Romans 2. You know, you are storing up wrath in yourselves against the revelation of the righteous judgment of God.
I think what's difficult is that there's so many aspects to this that it's easy to get caught up on one aspect and not realize we're talking about a part of the whole. But where it says here, he will realize because of transgression, his soul is cut off from God, and that God's wrath abides on him. And that's because he's cut off from God. He thinks God is angry with him. This is the fire unquenchable. and by it every unrepentant sinner will be destroyed.
Because love is unquenchable.
Because that fire is burning within them. They are being tortured by it. Because right. We were made to live in God's presence. We weren't made to die
right.
In God's presence.
Right.
And clinging to sin causes us to have an opposite reaction to what we are designed for. We were designed for ecstasy, but when we're allergic to it, it feels like torment.
Right.
I mean, it a crude analogy is, I've always loved to go on roller coasters, so it brings great thrills to me. My wife gets on them and experiences great terror. It's the exact same thing. But our reactions are opposite.
I don't know if this will be helpful, but as a electrical engineer, electricity is another form of fire. It's just power. I mean, it's just raw energy. And the amount of energy that something can handle is a function of its resistance. So if you don't have any resistance, you can take a huge amount of power through you. On the other hand, if you're resisting the flow, that flow turns into heat and just destroys anything that resists it.
That's right.
So, you know, the words work out well. Actually, the concept is pretty good too. It's not that the energy is mad at the resistance. It's just that's the way it works.
Yeah.
And if you're going to resist it, you either can't have the power, or it's going to destroy you.
That's right. Yeah, I believe electricity is given to us as one of the best metaphors of the spiritual reality of God's fire.
So is the fire that consumes sin combustional, a combustion fire, or is it more, because some would argue that combustion fire burns up material substance and furniture and books and molecules, etc. But sin is more not really idea. Sin is more ideas, thoughts, concepts, and attitudes. So I'm thinking sin is...
Okay, Brad. Nadab and Abihu died in fire that came forth from Yahweh.
Right.
They took them out at their tunics
right.
to bury them.
Right.
They were still bodies.
Right.
They were still bodies. They were not consumed.
Right. Non-combustion fire.
But it said they were consumed.
I think that's why, yeah. What the fire consumes is holy fire. It's not the fire like we light a match and try to burn something up. It's not at all that kind of fire.
Right.
So we're not dualists, I don't think, in that we don't think that there's material on one side and spiritual on the other. We believe that we're psychophysical beings, and yes, the two are connected. So it's obvious that the spiritual side, this other side, has direct impact on what happens in our physical bodies. And I think that that's what we're talking about here, is that when God finally releases all this, he's holding it under his hand so that we can see what's going on. But when God finally releases it, we see the full physical effects of the evil attitudes. And we don't really know how that physical interaction works, other than it being kind of obvious that it's there, because God created us both as spiritual beings in a physical body, and we, as far as we know, you can't have one without the other. So there is an obvious interaction between the two. And what we're talking about here is the ultimate destruction of that physical body, because it's out of harmony with the spiritual energy, for lack of a better word.
Right. No, I'd say it this way. The fire of infinite love is painful only when the mind is not transformed,
mm-hmm.
or evil, mm-hmm.
When you're resisting the transformation.
We've rejected his love. And I know of people who hate the love of God, and they think that nobody should talk about it. That person would be very tormented by God's love.
They're already tormented by it. That's why they hate it.
They're already tormented. That's why they hate it.
Well, and when Jesus returns, he's not cloaking his glory. It's full on.
Well, it's full on at the very, very end. But I think even at the second coming and the return of the city of Jerusalem, until that very end, God is, in fact, I think, cloaking it to some extent. He has to, or else they would just be gone.
I would agree.
Yeah, I think he is to an extent, but he has it unveiled enough that they are destroyed by the brightness, which simply means they go to sleep.
But I was just saying that word brightness is not about fire. That word brightness is the Greek word for epiphany. They have a huge epiphany that shatters the whole picture of reality. And everything they've believed and perceived as real is suddenly busted up by this invasion of the truth about God. And they just come unglued.
You could liken it to the death of Ananias and Sapphira.
Yeah.
They were met with the truth, and it shocked them to the point of death.
Right. I'd like to know why, or maybe explore a little more, and I know we touched on it previously, and where was it, chapter 10? The fifth trumpet, wherever that is. That's the last time we've seen a key and the abyss. And at that point, Satan received the key to the abyss and opened the abyss, and all that smoke come pouring out. Now, we've got this angel coming down from heaven who suddenly has the key. And he opens up the abyss and puts the source of the smoke back in there and locks it up. They're clearly either bookends, or they're definitely linked to each other. And I'm just curious as to how much they feed off each other and what the implications are.
Well, let's see if we can find is the fifth angel? Yes, chapter 9. And the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star that was fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. And he opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given authority like the authority of the scorpions on the earth. They were told not to damage the grass and so on.
And then in verse 11, which I think is the last verse in that chapter.
It's not the last. It's the next to the last.
Is that the last one in the fifth trumpet? Or is that in the sixth trumpet?
Verse 11 says they have a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he is called Apollyon.
Yeah.
Baden, it exists in Akkadian as well as Hebrew, and it means total destruction.
So clearly the bad guy has the key to the bottomless pit in chapter 9.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess sort of one of the obvious questions is, how did he lose the key? When did it change hands? Or how does that happen? I mean, that's what I do. I ask lots of questions.
I find it confusing that Satan would have the key of the bottomless pit.
But the star that has fallen from earth to heaven would have to be Satan. The star represents angel in the Bible. And what angel fell it wasn't Satan.
What's it mean that he's given the key, though?
Yeah. Like, I don't think it means literally given, and that there's a literal key. I think, you know, that this is revelatory. And so it's the time in history where something is about to take place, whether it's the first time or the second time. It's all revelatory, or based upon the free will choices of free moral agents. And so it's not arbitrary. At least that's my understanding at the moment.
Well, I definitely agree that it's not a literal key, but the symbolism of a key is that it you have the key, you have control over the thing.
Yeah.
So Satan is given control over the bottomless pit.
Let me talk about the abyss a little bit. In Old Testament, we have this, and I think it's similar to, you know, you have the deep in the sea. All that represents chaos. And so sealing up the pit is to remove chaos and restore order, whereas opening the abyss means to let go of chaos.
So there's a time for everything.
Mm-hmm.
A time that chaos is released and a time that chaos is curtailed.
Mm-hmm. So it would be when in chapter 20, he holding hand, he has somehow, apparently Satan has relinquished the key, is my guess.
So what would we think the abyss or the bottomless pit is? Are we talking about Earth? Or are we talking about something else?
This is not, the important thing is not to take it literally. It's a term for a chaos. The abyss is chaos.
So he's given control over chaos.
Yeah.
I think it's important to also link that with the brief discussion that Jesus had with some demons who were begging him not to send them to the abyss.
Oh, that's right.
Which means they are afraid of the abyss.
Mm-hmm.
Whether, I mean, it almost acts like it's a prison that they are put into by whoever, maybe even Satan, when they're not doing enough work tormenting humans. I think Satan is obviously the most tyrannical boss ever, the boss from hell, literally. And I believe he treats his demonic subjects ruthlessly, mercilessly, viciously, even if they don't do what he wants. And they're begging Jesus, basically, don't turn us over to what Satan wants to do to us if he catches us running around.
That's interesting.
Maybe the point here is that all along, Satan has claimed that his way would work. The great controversy is over, proven that it's not. And God finally says, okay, this one is yours. You got control. You got total control over this. Do whatever you want. And the results are that he can't do anything with it.
Except create more chaos.
Create more chaos, yeah.
I mean, the whole fifth and sixth trumpet are a result of opening the abyss.
Yeah, and they're chaos. That's chaos. If Satan has the key over the abyss, if he has the key over the abyss, and I'm thinking back to what Jesus did and the demons begging him not to send them to the abyss. They did not want him throwing them into the Sea of Galilee, because all bodies of waters are very repugnant to demons.
They threw themselves in there.
They didn't. They threw themselves in the pigs, and the pigs took them there. So it backfired.
Well, the pigs wouldn't have gone there if they hadn't gotten into them.
Right, but you know, we're not always really smart with things we're given.
That's for sure.
Because we shouldn't take that too literally either. That the demons are actually afraid of water. The symbolism you have to go with.
The deep and the, okay, in Genesis 1, it's Dahomey. The deep is a place of chaos. In ancient Near Eastern mythology, it's very much a place of chaos and evil.
And darkness.
And darkness. And you have darkness there too, in Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that Genesis 1 actually encrypts the great controversy.
Yeah.
And God's way of dealing with evil is transformative. He transforms it into good.
With just his word.
With just his word, yes. And I think it's very important that we always have that chapter with its connotations mm-hmm. carefully in mind, because they're foundational to everything else in Scripture.
And Anna was telling me that she was listening to a teacher that is linking Genesis 1 with Revelation, Genesis 1 and 2, and showing all these parallels between the two books.
Hmm. Who is this?
Anna.
Oh, Anna.
She could tell you who I was talking about. She was telling me about it a few weeks ago.
I would love to get a hold of that.
I could send a link in the chat.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
I was going to inject a comment that, you know, the story I'm trying to write is a non-religious backstory for all of us. And as I've been thinking about it, the encryption of all this into a few verses in Genesis should remind us that a vast and infinite universe is going to have layers of complexity and diversity beyond our imagination. And we can't forget that when we look at something like Genesis that boils all that down into a few words that are relevant to our situation. The actual universe out there is going to be complex beyond imagining.
She also was talking about what you guys were saying about the Hebrew, the chaos and the waters, because she goes through Genesis. Some of the stuff you guys were talking about, she has correlations in. And I kind of listen to a diverse things, and I like to glean from people.
Yeah.
So I think
we appreciate she got it.
A lot of good things to glean from.
I appreciate this, Anna, very much. Because I do a lot of narrative reading and also canonical reading with it of the Old Testament. And I'm more and more convinced the more I study that creation, what happens in creation, is foundational to everything else. So I really appreciate having this additional work done. Is this woman Jewish?
She's Messianic.
Messianic Jewish.
She used to be from the... actually, don't know a terrible lot about her background, but I know that she was on a Messianic TV program for a while. Someone introduced her to me because I was very interested in Genesis and Revelation, and she has a lot of really good correlations between Genesis and Revelation. So I'm actually still going through her study with somebody else.
Okay. That's great. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it, because this may give me some additional impetus for what I'm doing and additional help. Well, it's 5:03. What do you want to do?
Well, we can start up next week.
Yeah, we're not quite done, are we, with this discussion?
No.
I could do more research on Abaddon and the abyss.
And the key and the chain.
And the key and the chain.
There's two different things there. You got a key and a chain, but there's no lock.
Interesting. Would this be deliberate to emphasize that God isn't doing it?
Yeah, good question.
That they're still free?
He seals it. Does that imply a lock? It sort of implies it, I guess.
Well, you don't need a key for a seal.
Yeah, I mean, even in verse 3, it's interesting how it itemizes. And, these books don't mince words, so every phrase is worth like flushing out in the open. So it says he cast him, then he shut it, and then he sealed it. You got three things in a row, and that always just raises lots of questions for me.
Yeah, it just says he threw him into the pit, locked it, and sealed it over him so that he would deceive the nations no more until the 1,000 years were ended.
Just before or after he gets the key?
What verse says he gets the key?
Well, we don't know. We don't know how he got the key, because the key was originally in Satan's hands.
What is it we're talking about now?
It says an angel came down from heaven. That doesn't even positively identify them.
However, an angel coming down from heaven is often Jesus.
But the star came down from heaven too.
Yes, that's true. But it fell from heaven. That's the yeah. crucial difference.
Okay. I'm just saying it's not a positive ID, it's an inferred ID.
All right. And the end of verse 3 says he has to be set free for a short time. Is that what the key is for?
Where are you guys reading key? Again, we're trying
first,
to find it.
First verse, 21.
Revelation 21 and 3. And yeah, that's also extremely important that he must be loosed.
Yeah.
Where do you get that Satan gets the key? I'm not seeing that, but that's what I was trying to find.
Chapter 20, verse 3.
Yeah, but okay, well.
And chapter 19, verse 1. And that has the key in it.
You mean verse 9, chapter 9?
Chapter 19, I'm sorry. No. In chapter 20, verse 1. I saw an angel coming down from heaven holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit.
To the abyss, right. And a great chain.
Yes, and a great chain. He seized the dragon, the ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the he would deceive the nations no more until 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be let out for a little while.
Right, that's why verse 7 says once the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be set free from the prison and will go out and save the nations. Mm-hmm. His 1,000 years led to no repentance, turning away from right back to his old tricks. So what's the question for our consideration between now and next time?
What is the key? What does it represent? What is the key and what is the chain and where's the lock? It just seems, I think we have to reinterpret key along different lines than we think of as a key to a lock. We think of key in terms of locks, but key could mean something different.
Could be.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just says the key, and it talks about him being bound in chains, not a prison door. But, you know, you do have keys that open or close locks on the chains. Seems to me that's what it's a reference to. But just looking at what's provided there. But, you know, he's out of commission. All of these are ways of saying he's out of commission. He does not have access. He's not as free as he's been for the time frame that he has been. And of course, in contacts, that's because everybody's dead that he's been deceiving.
I have two versions, two translations, RSVs, the key of the bottomless pit. And verse 1. Another one says, holding a heavy chain and a key, the key of the deep, if that adds any confusion.
Hey, I just had a thought.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the bottom, or earlier, Gene was talking about the bottomless pit being like chaos. And the key to chaos originally started with Satan. Like, there was no chaos. It was perfect peace, harmony, everything. And then chaos started with Satan. So Satan comes down. He has the key to the bottomless pit. He unleashes more chaos. And chaos is reigning on the earth. And then during the 1,000 years, chaos, there's instead of the key to open chaos, which started with Satan, now it's the key to closing chaos for a period of respite, and the key to chaos is shut up in the bottomless pit, Satan himself, and so chaos is shut up, and then it must be loosed a little season later as a revelatory event.
Makes sense, Aaron.
It looks like the chain, like if you look in the Strong's, is to bind the hands and the feet, and they liken it to a pair of handcuffs. So the key and the chain would go together if it was handcuffs.
I still think that this is figurative language.
Mm-hmm.
And that the key, the chain and the key is simply what Satan has done to himself. He has no one else, no one left to conquer. He's isolated.
Yeah.
In other places in the Bible, the pit is referred to as death, correct? Pit of death. And so Satan's chaos results in death, which in turn even chains himself, because he has destroyed all that had occupied him in terms of people, nations, organizations. And now with everyone dead, he's created his own chains in a respect that he can't do anything.
This is interesting. I'm in Sigvatonstad's Revelation commentary, and he translates this verses 1 through 3. And I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the abyss and have a huge chain in his hand, the mudslinger and antagonist, that is the devil and Satan. And he tied him up for 1,000 years, tied him up with a chain.
Found him.
And then he locked it with a key somehow. You know, key, it can be ambiguous. It can mean a lot of different things. We talk about key metaphorically a lot. That's a key idea, or that's a...
Well, there's a key to understanding this.
It's a key statement. It's, you know, there's lots of uses of key.
Agreed.
But it seems like this key is linked with access to the abyss.
Or not access.
Either denying access or gaining access to the pit. So it's definitely linked with the pit. Whereas the chain is more about the devil, the key is more about the abyss.
However it works, it seems clear that Satan has been given some authority, but, or power, control, but this is a very limited area. So he's trapped in one particular place.
Mm-hmm.
That seems clear.
And I think that parallels what we read in Isaiah 14, where it says, you have killed your own people.
Mm-hmm. I see so much of Revelation in that chapter.
Yeah.
And I never would have seen if we hadn't had this discussion. And that means it's very possible that Revelation is referencing Isaiah 14.
And whoever has the keys has the power to open and shut.
And in
To provide
chapter one,
access.
Chapter one, I have the keys to death and the grave.
Mm-hmm.
Point, because Jesus,
he
Jesus
simply...
came for three reasons, right? Didn't he come to destroy the devil, destroy the devil's work, which is father of all lies, destroy lies, which is about revealing truth and light. And then what was the other thing? Jesus came to destroy the devil himself. So death, the devil, and his work, if I remember right.
And the only way that could be done is revelatory, because he has to appeal to the earth. But he didn't do it that way, because that actually wouldn't have worked.
Well,
it would have caused more questions. And that's also not God's heart.
Correct.
You were going to say something, Gene?
Well, I was just going to say pretty much what you said, that this isn't the way God does things. And if he were to use force on Satan, Satan would say, you're right. See, I'm right. You're a God of force.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then that's what came, this is what was like coming to my mind when Brad was talking, is Jesus came to destroy Satan. Well, how did he do it?
He did
by
it
letting
not by
Satan,
force, but by
basically,
revelation.
You know, by letting Satan try to destroy him.
If anybody likes Great Controversy, great reference to this is on page 498. Starts with, in his dealing with sin, God could employ only righteousness and truth. Satan could use what God could not, flattery and lies. He had sought to falsify the word of God and misrepresented his plan of government before the angels, claiming that God was not just in laying laws and rules upon the inhabitants of heaven and earth. Anyway, there it goes on, but God's government was just and his law was perfect, and Satan claimed it was otherwise.
I think of first statement in Isaiah 7:59. God, just the one that Aaron was quoting. God could have destroyed Satan and his followers as easily as one can.
Exactly.
Cast a pebble to the earth, but he would not do this. Rebellion won by force. Compelling power is found only under Satan's government. And the Lord's principles are not of this order. His authority rests upon goodness, mercy, and love. And the presentation, revelation, of these principles is the means to be used.
So his goodness, mercy, and love are in this revelation passage. The chains, the key, it's all within the context of goodness, mercy, and love.
Yeah. There's more going on than, you know, we're kind of stuck on the physical aspect and trying to make that work. I don't think we can.
Yeah, I like what you said, that it's metaphorical. It's like it means something not literal.
Right.
I think that's true. The key to understanding Revelation is symbolic.
Yeah.
First.
The key. I like the way you use the key.
There, we're going to the key to discovering what key means.
That was one of the two keys that I was given from Revelation 1:1 at the very beginning of my study years ago, is that if you, God said, if you use these two keys, you'll be able to understand anything in the whole book. And it was right. And one key is it has to agree with the Jesus-looking God. And number two, everything in this book is symbolic. Everything in this book is symbolic. And if you approach it that way, it'll come unglued.
So I have a suggestion. The key to the bottomless pit is the revelation of what sin has done to Satan's kingdom. And it has completely stymied him and put him out of access to human beings.
So is this saying that the angel coming down out of heaven, which could be the second coming, the epiphany that happens at the second coming, is the key or the pivotal action that induces the circumstances which leaves Satan trapped?
Yeah, here's one thing we've left out of that sequence. Just before Jesus comes, Satan has masqueraded as Jesus. And he has deceived the whole world. So the whole world's worshiping him, and he's, yay, I'm triumphant.
And then the real one shows up.
And then the real one comes. And all his faithful followers say, "This is our God. We have waited for him, and he will save us."
And we waited because we didn't buy in to the last
one. Exactly. Exactly.
We refused to buy into the counterfeit, even at the threat of their lives. Oh, this is the Lamb version of God. That's the right one.
It's funny that both sides react the same way to the appearance of their Messiah. The bad people say, "Oh, this is the guy we've wanted."
Yep. You get what you ask for.
You get but it's a little different. This is the real one.
Yeah.
It's what the saints say.
In both cases, someone appears who is aligned with what already decided they want.
Who meets their expectations.
I think there's just
somebody said the people get the government they deserve, and I think the same is true of God's. People get the God they deserve.
That's for sure. Well, why don't we call it quits for tonight? And hopefully we'll be able to pick up on this next week after we've done a little more research. Okay, let's have closing prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for the stimulating discussions we've had this afternoon. Thank you that you have led us and guided us, and though we still have some things to accomplish, we know that you will guide us through these. Be with us and keep us till another week. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.